This is Fully Vested, a weekly podcast where Jason Rowley and Graham Peck discuss technology and venture capital investing. This week, we discuss Silicon Valley's growing preference for investments with a path to pragmatic profitability, the Q3 2019 venture capital macro trends, as reported by Crunchbase News, and the reduction of venture capital deals in China, especially supergiant venture capital deals. This show was recorded on October 13th. You can learn more at fullyvested.co.
That on the mirror there is me helping coach a startup with reorganization of their pitch deck. So those post-it notes are actually a startup pitch.
I also have an array of post-it notes. But my array of post-it notes is, what is sticking up? Oh, it's my water bottle. My array of post-it notes is mostly to-do items and what do I got up there? Oh, I have a 25% off Crunchbase Pro code, good through October and November. So Graham, if you know of anybody who needs a friends and family Crunchbase Pro code, let me know.
You could definitely pass that out to our to our listening audience.
I don't know. Should I? Yeah, why not? This is, first off, Crunchbase is not a sponsor. They just pay for my health insurance and nominally my salary too. But I guess you know, since we're recording, I might as well just say that if you want 25% off of a Crunchbase Pro subscription, good through October and November of 2019, you can use in all caps CBPROON2. When you sign up for Crunchbase, and you get 25% off of a full year of Crunchbase Pro, which is a non-trivial amount of money.
Would highly recommend.
We
use it heavily.
Graham, I got to sneeze. This is...
Uh-oh. Bless you. Wow.
It's
our listeners are getting all kinds of benefits today.
I had a little bowl of pistachio shells, so we could have done like a little bit of a ASMR.
There you go. I mean, you can't eat just one pistachio.
Oh my God. I had the exact same thought. You can't eat just one pistachio. It's like Pringles, also not a sponsor. It's, you know, once you pop, you the fun don't stop.
I haven't tried combining the different ones like they do in that one commercial, you know, like there's the this and then the chicken flavored this and then the jalapeno and they make a spicy jalapeno chicken barbecue pizza out of Pringle flavors.
No.
I haven't done this yet. I want to experience
you
this.
You know what it is, Graham? It's that I don't have the disposable income to acquire that many different varieties of Pringles.
You're a one Pringles flavor at a time kind of guy.
That's a luxury that's above my pay grade.
Oh.
You know what else is above my pay grade is the pre-shelled pistachios.
Oh yeah, so then you've got the shells,
right? So you go to
added
the
benefit,
right? So you go to the you go to the local Amazon fancy food emporium, and you go to the bulk bin and you purchase many pounds of pistachios because that's just the kind of gentleman that I am, and you realize that they're what they're like you know $8-9 a pound. They're not cheap pistachios. I don't know.
Mm.
They're not cheap. But anyways, you go and you see like, oh, the shelled pistachios. And then you realize that they're like three times more expensive. And you're like, how are they shelling these pistachios? Are these like artisanal, like hand cracked pistachios, Graham?
Artisanally shelled. Yeah.
Mm. As I drink my my vegetable broth. OK,
but then you're paying for the weight of the shells, too.
Yeah. Well, you're not wrong, but there's also, you know, Graham, no, hang on.
You should do some math on this.
Hang on. The shells, first off, the shells are great on pistachios because you get the tactile joy of like breaking apart something very, you know, very small. And then you get this like little nut in the middle and the nut's delicious, but it creates, it slows you down. Do you know how many pistachios I would just like gulp down if I didn't have to shell them all?
Oh, and yeah, and you get the added benefit of burning calories while you're shelling them, right?
Yeah, and then you have, and then you get a nice... That's
a non-trivial amount of exercise for somebody like me.
Well, I mean, for somebody...
Oh, boy.
Then you also get the bowl of pistachio shells that you can use on a, as an impromptu maraca during your ostensibly venture capital focused podcast you're doing with a friend on a Sunday morning. Isn't that right, Graham Peck?
That's right.
All right. All right, Graham. This has been the show.
Oh, yeah.
We've been recording. I think we should we have a number of topics to talk about today. But before we do, I think we should tell our extraordinarily vast and fabulous listening audience who we are and what we're doing here.
Well, all right. I'll dive right into that. My name is Graham Peck. I'm a venture partner with Cultivation Capital, which is a Midwestern-based venture fund that invests in early stage life sciences, ag tech, and what I specifically work on is our technology-focused fund. We invest in late seed and early series A stage B2B SaaS softwares, regardless of industry. In addition to that work, I also help startups and larger companies build their technology teams by working with some great staff aug partners. And this is fully vested.
This is fully vested. Okay.
It is.
All right.
And Jason, who are you?
Hey, everybody. My name is Jason Rowley. I keep myself mostly busy by writing things on the internet for Crunchbase News, where I cover the wild and woolly world of venture capital and other private tech company finance. And let's see what else I do. I do a bunch of data visualizations for them, which we are probably going to end up discussing at length today, Graham. But when I'm not doing that, I do a little bit of volunteer work with the Python Software Foundation, helping them reach out to early stage startups. What else? Oh, I have a newsletter. Everybody should subscribe. You can go to rowley.report, where you can keep up with the stuff that I write on the internet and stuff that I read on the internet. So, got a lot of fingers and lots of pots, Graham. So, speaking of lots of fingers and lots of pots, we have two sort of main topic areas and a third that I propose that we lead off with. Our sort of two main topics today are the global venture capital report that I wrote for Crunchbase News, and we are also going to be mentioning some sort of large scale dynamics in that report. I'm sorry that was not specifically covered in that report, but that we'd covered elsewhere. Which is that China, the venture ecosystem in China is not doing too great. So those are our two main subject areas. And then, but Graham, do you want to first, we can first start chatting about how all of a sudden those old school Midwestern investor values about, oh, I don't know, being focused on whether or not a business is actually like, sound from like a unit economics standpoint or trying to grow sustainably or all those things that, coastal investors have sort of poo-pooed Chicago and the rest of the Midwest for. I guess that's back in fashion now all of a sudden.
Well, it's really interesting when, you're going to build a business and you want to eventually make a profit. What a crazy idea, right?
And I mean, it's you might even say this is a totally disruptive notion these days.
You know, coming from a longstanding family business, I didn't mention this in my intro, but I'm a third generation member of a business that's been operated now for 73 years. We're certainly not profitable every year. And as many private businesses are, we managed to, you know, to a low tax profit. But you know, and I don't think we would have been around for 73 years if we didn't overall, you know, make money. We try to run our business for the, you know, specifically for the benefit of our employees and community. But I think we'd be doing a huge disservice to our shareholders, all of which I'm related to through blood or marriage, if we didn't also make money from time to time. And so, you know, it doesn't seem like a new trend in business, but I'm glad to see the Valley and some of the other more larger venture areas kind of catching on to that.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And it's refreshing to see what feels like, you know, something relatively self-evident, like, oh yeah, you know, companies should try to be profitable at some point. You know, growing at all costs is not always a sustainable venture, or it's not always a sustainable prospect that will, you know, result in positive outcomes for a venture. It's kind of fun to see that whole world come full circle, and then now to see a bunch of people on you know, various corners of the internet that I follow around, start talking about how it's important for companies to start looking for a way to become profitable within the next, you know, sort of like 12 to 18 months. You know, folks are starting to really, I don't know if this is a, if this is really it just a, just like everybody's starting to think about the economy, or if this is a reaction to, you know, a lot of these like wildly unprofitable companies attempting to go public. But it really does seem like there's a real moment of reckoning and reconsideration, going on right now.
Well, I think that, you know, we went through an era of, you know, Silicon Valley and less investing in companies where the goal was get as many eyeballs on your product as possible, and we'll figure the rest out later. You know, and that was probably fine for Google and Facebook and other companies that were able to relatively easily add a business model that was driven by advertising dollars. I don't know if this is a trend that you or Crunchbase has specifically noticed, but you know, we see a fair amount of marketing technology or MarTech at you know, at Cultivation, and that industry has seemed to really take it on the chin lately. And you know, I think that people are being driven towards, let's find ways to add real value in people's lives beyond just, oh, or have a business model, I guess I should say, that's more than just, oh yeah, you know, fine, we'll put ads over on the side. And I think that that's good, because I think there's a lot of other great business models out there. You know, and so now I think the, you know, kind of next wave is, hey, growth at all costs is not necessarily a good thing.
Right. Or, you know, grow at all costs, but have like an end goal in mind. Right. And the end goal is, should not be, in most cases, if you're talking about anything except for like a giant digital platform business, the end goal should not be world domination. Right. The end goal should. Yeah, Graham.
No, I was just going to say that I completely agree. You know, and another way to look at it is, you know, a lot of businesses we're starting to see seem to be either at or know how they can very quickly get to a point where they are growing, maybe not at all costs, but at many costs, but that's a very controllable thing. And they could turn that spend off tomorrow or at some relatively soon interval and still run a profitable business. And that's something that honestly, I think we're starting to look for, is either what's the shortest path if we wanted to take it to profitability, just as an option, not saying that's what we'll encourage them to do,
right,
or how we'll encourage them to invest in their growth, but that's an important option or time frame to be aware of. And I definitely think that there's value in that.
I have a quick question for you though, before we dive into any parts of the report, or glancingly mention, you know, stuff going on in China. What are the primary, apart from, you know, the obvious point, apart from like obvious, you know, routes like layoffs or stuff like that, like what are some strategies that companies can undertake to achieve, you know, profitability or to make the transition from like, you know, high growth to focusing on profitability? Are layoffs the only option, or are there other, you know, strategies that can be employed here?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm certain that this won't be a comprehensive list, but a couple of companies that I work closely with in our portfolio, or I'm certainly very, very well aware of what their kind of burn trajectories are. I mean, they're paying for ads and, you know, on the internet. So they, a part of, certainly not all of their customer growth strategy, but a part of their customer growth strategy is using Google ads or Facebook ads or the like to gain some traction with a portion of their audience. And, you know, we look very closely at, with a couple of our companies at least, could they turn that off? And then how quickly would they become profitable? Some of those obviously then are bringing people in a monthly or quarterly kind of cohort basis. And so we look back at, you know, cost of acquisition and lifetime value of those customers on those cohort bases. And in many cases, or at least again, in a couple of cases, if they just turned off the marketing spend, their growth might go down a lot, but they could become profitable again, in at least one case, tomorrow or very, very quickly.
Yeah,
So said another way, they spend on a monthly basis for future growth because we now have enough data on prior cohorts. They spend money to grow today and pay for users, but they know that over a defined period of time that we usually target being sub 12 months, that user will make them more money on average than they're paying for them.
Right.
But they are also burning money on a monthly net basis, but they're doing that in a very controllable way. That again leads to profit on average on that cohort in less than 12 months, we hope, or that's our target. May or may not be true every time, but that's the target. And but again, that's a very controllable metric, right? You can scale up or scale down your Google ads or Facebook ads tomorrow, and that wouldn't affect the FTE headcount at least one of the startups that I'm thinking, at least two of the startups I'm thinking of that are portfolio companies of ours at all. Now, their marketing people might be less busy, so there might be some task adjusting inside their marketing teams.
Sure.
But they wouldn't lay people off. They'd just shut off their marketing or dramatically reduce it.
Yeah. No, that I was forgetting about that because it sort of goes back to that conversation we had about Mary Meeker's Internet Trends Report and, you know, other statistics that came out around the time that report was put out. You know, I forget what the exact numbers was, but or were rather. God, man, grammar is hard. But yeah, it's something like, you know, the average venture-backed startup, you know, spends
about 42% is what my recollection
is.
Yeah,
it was something like that. It was some absolutely insane number. So yeah, I was neglecting, perhaps it was just the, perhaps it's just that I have WeWork too much on the brain or all these, you know, giant, Silicon Valley, you know, well, sorry, WeWork is, as many are very quick to point out, WeWork is not a Silicon Valley company. It's based in New York City, but you get the idea. There's a lot of companies that have, you know, grown incredibly quickly, that are now forced to start considering paths to profitability. And at least for certain very large organizations, that has the word layoffs is becoming more, more part of the public consciousness there. So
I think to close that point and make what Jason said, you know, a more complete point, that 42% that I quoted, I think, is the amount of average venture dollars that end up getting spent on internet advertising. And if we can find a link to that or some similar data source, we'll include that in the show notes.
The show notes.
I guess one other closing thought on this topic for me is that it's interesting to see Silicon Valley find ideas that are not new or novel and glom onto them in such a way that they believe, maybe because of the echo chamber they live in, that they invented them, like path to profitability and startup investing. And I guess one of the other things that I have seen that was kind of a thought that they seem that in their minds invented, and that's, you know, lean startup methodology. And while there's a huge difference between that and lean in the parlance of manufacturing,
yeah,
the concepts are actually very similar.
No, they're based on, it's based right, on and, lean manufacturing.
Right. And so Silicon Valley, in my mind, at least, seems to have invented the lean methodology, or maybe in their mind seems to have invented the lean methodology, where in reality that was invented by Japanese manufacturers during and shortly after World War II, and is, you know, the same kind of methodology that we've used in my family's manufacturing company for the last 20 or 30 years now. So, anyway, it's just interesting to watch them glom onto a concept like profitable or near profitable startup investing,
yep,
or past the profitability startup investing, I guess I might call it, and then think that that's something that's novel when broadly we Midwestern investors have been looking at that all along.
For sure.
Or for a long time.
Well, yes.
Yeah, I'm painting several awfully broad brushes there.
Yeah, Graham, we got to get you, we could do a recording junket out to San Francisco.
Oh, we should definitely do it. I'm in.
Oh, excellent. you'll lead the trip. I'll follow on. Graham, I wrote a big book report.
Yeah. How many words in this one? I didn't do
it. It's long, Graham. It's like 30. It's many words.
Is this the longest one?
No. No.
Oh.
No.
Oh, Jason, bless you.
Yeah, bless my heart. This is a long one. It's like 3200 odd words. And they're all the words are odd.
It's like is that quote, right? The odds are good that the goods are odd.
Yeah.
Right?
that was the dating scene down at UChicago.
Yeah. And I think the where I had heard that first was the dating scene in either Silicon Valley or kind of maybe the Seattle area is obviously big tech hubs.
Well, but see, anyway. In Seattle, at least everybody's dressed to go on like a backpacking trip at a moment's notice.
Right.
Okay. All right. What are we talking about?
Talk about the Q3 2019 Global Venture Capital Report. Seed stage deals increase while broader funding environment shows signs of erosion. That's the title.
It's a very cheerful title.
Written by our wonderful co-host here, Jason Rowley.
That's indeed correct. So, quick little bit of context before we get into any of the content of the report. So Crunchbase News, Graham, this is now, I get to now be the podcast co-host that gets to reference my appearance on another podcast. So Crunchbase News, we recently started a little podcast mini series. I don't think it's going to go on for much more than, you know, a half dozen or a dozen episodes. But I was just on it, you know, where I got to explain some of the findings from the report. And I got to explain some of the background. And I'm going to make the assumption that anybody who's listening to this did not listen to that short podcast episode that I did, but a little bit of context. So since Crunchbase News started a little under 3 years ago, so March of 2020 is going to be Crunchbase News' 3-year anniversary, we've been sort of responsible for leading Crunchbase's quarterly reporting cycle. And in fact, there was, to my knowledge, there was no quarterly report before Crunchbase News started. And so we basically take a whole bunch of Crunchbase data. We run it through some a projection methodology, which takes into account stuff like historical patterns of like late reporting. So, for example, if you're like a seed stage startup, or you know, if you're like just freshly started up, chances are you might not have taken the time to put up a Crunchbase profile and updated it with all of your all of your individual like pre-seed checks or the little angel checks or whatever. It often takes a little, lot of time to get that information into Crunchbase. Sometimes several quarters, sometimes, more than a year.
And I think we've talked about this before. Do you know what the average kind of reporting delay is? Obviously, we know that it's longer at early stages.
Yeah. So it's a challenging question to answer very directly, but I'm going to try. So, in general, I'm going to speak in pretty rough numbers here. In general, like Crunchbase, so the way that we calculate this out is we assume that after 2 years, every deal that will have been added to Crunchbase has been added to Crunchbase. And that might be, that's a bit of an assumption. Maybe that number is closer to 98-99%, but whatever. So we have this 2 year window, and we go back and we say, okay, there's a date on which the round has been created in the database, and we have the date in which they say the round was announced. And so the round may have been announced a year ago, but may have only been created in the data set today, because maybe somebody just put up their Crunchbase profile today or whatever. And so, we calculate the difference, those differences over time, and we assume that, or based on our calculations, well, not News's calculations, Crunchbase itself's calculations, on average, looking back at this one quarter, like the quarter that just recently ended, we assume that we have somewhere on the order of, I can actually pull this up for you, Graham. We assume that we have something on the order of 30 or 40% of all the seed stage deals that have currently been announced. We have something on the order of 40 or 50% or 60%, whatever, of the early stage deals that were announced, and, little bit higher margin of late stage deals, because late stage deals get announced. Those tend to carry much better press coverage. And all the rest. I don't have the specific numbers in front of me. I could have pulled it up. This might actually be a thing that we put in the show notes. Maybe not. Where did we go with? I went down this rabbit hole of projection methodology, which has now led me to opening the funding dashboard, because I want to answer your question, Graham.
Well, I was asking about average delays in reporting, and I know obviously it's higher at earlier stage deals. And obviously your headline covered, kind of the two biggest trends, and I think without kind of combining our two major topics, although they are closely related, I think the headline does a great job of identifying the two biggest trends, is that we're seeing, all-time records in the number of seed stage funding, while at the same time seeing an overall decline in the funding dollars. And so at a high level, before digging into any of those specifics, and I've got obviously comments on several of those, but also a pretty detailed list of several questions for you to, I think, take a few of the subtopics further than the article did. What do you think about those two trends at a high level? I mean, those are interesting trends to observe. So highest deal count of all time, yet a lower funding than one quarter ago or 1 year ago, same quarter. So what does that, what do those two things mean in your opinion?
Okay, so I'm going to take the second question first. So I think the stuff about dollar volume is relatively easily explained by a couple of different macro level trends. One of which is what we'll get into later, is the situation happening in China's venture market. And then, you know, but again, we'll put that in a box. We'll put a pin in it. We'll circle back later, Graham. I think that the other big ones are that the companies that had historically raised the most from private markets have now in the last quarter or two graduated to raising money from public markets. And so they're not going to go out. So like, for example, like Uber raised, you know, like at something like $15 billion plus or minus in venture funding, right? Uber is now a publicly traded company. It is not going to be raising additional financing from venture capitalists or in a round that would be counted as a VC round by Crunchbase's classification rules. You know, the same is true with a lot of the other most funded companies of this recent generation. You know, Lyft has already gone public. WeWork is, well, you know, WeWork is WeWork. They've not gone public, and they're probably not going to be raising much more anytime soon. So I think like the dollar volume stuff is just a matter of like, yeah, there's like fewer companies needing to take down such ridiculously, you know, big checks to keep growing. This is not to, and by the way, this is not to say that like late stage deal volume is like going off a cliff. It's not. Late stage deal volume is up, 5.4% relative to last quarter, and projected dollar volume at late stage is also up 12.4% relative to last quarter. But, you know, it's just not the same as the way it was in like early 2018, late 2017, where you just had so many companies raising, you know, like anywhere between like $200 million and $1 billion at a time, just to keep growing before they sought additional financing from public markets. So I think that's the big one there. And then as for the seed stage,
one quick note I've got on that.
Sure.
You know, one of the things that I thought was interesting in reviewing the stats that your article covered was that you know, and obviously we'll talk about China and its implications, which has also been kind of a recurring theme. You know, maybe a little bit later. Although again, I think to some extent these two topics are mixed and closely related just because of coincidental timing of reporting.
Yeah.
But all of that being said, one of the things that I observed that was interesting is, you know, those hyper giant or super giant round reduction in dollar volume really is almost dollar for dollar equal to the entire reduction, I believe, quarter over quarter in venture funding, right? I think that super giant rounds were down about $2.9 billion quarter over quarter, and total funding down about $2.8 billion quarter over quarter. So taking out super giant rounds, there was actually a slight increase in total funding, if I'm getting my numbers right.
That is, so this Graham is where we get into the pleasures and sorrows of dealing with reported versus projected numbers. Yeah, you're correct that in terms of reported dollar volume, we've seen a decline in capital raised in, these super giant rounds. However, it should be noted that the projections that we report, because they're accounting for deals that have occurred but have not yet been added into Crunchbase for whatever reason, it's really hard to make apples to apples comparisons between those two sets of numbers. But yes, in general, you're not wrong. The number, so like the biggest deals that transpired, there was just a really great. Sorry, I don't mean to toot my own horn here, but there was a very eye-opening statistic that I pulled regarding, quoting myself here, which is very weird to do. This is regarding, if you are reading along at home, this is under the projected VC dollar volume heading of the report. Quote, however, we've seen in the past, part of this gap is attributable to outsized rounds, which, as outliers, can skew the numbers by a significant margin. For example, the top 10 largest startup funding rounds of Q3 2018, including a 13 billion RMB, so it's a Chinese-denominated Series B round closed by JD Digits, a 10 billion RMB Series A closed by a Chinese state-backed media company called CMC Inc., and $1 billion funding rounds each raised by the likes of SenseTime, Oyo, Grab, and Lucid Motors, each raised over $10.2 billion collectively. Now, that is Q3 of last year, Q3 2018. By comparison, the 10 largest rounds from the past quarter netted those companies about $7.3 billion in venture funding. Apart from the rounds raised by Argo AI and Absaroka Energy, there were no other rounds of $1 billion or more compared to six in Q3 2018. So I think also, like, what's happening is the size of deals at the very, very furthest extreme of the dollar spectrum, those are also going down as well.
Yeah, and that makes sense, I think, for a variety of reasons. So getting back to kind of headline level stuff, what were you going to say about seed stage deals and the increase in seed stage deals?
Yeah, so this is where I will put a small caveat on numbers that we reported in this report. And it's that the amount of rounds that are projected to be added can vary from year to year. So I'm not saying, by the way, first off, I'm not suggesting that I doubt the underlying accuracy of the model that Crunchbase has developed to do these projections. That's not what I'm saying. I'm wondering to what extent we are seeing like an actual material uptick in seed stage rounds versus is this a case of projections augmenting things maybe a little bit more than they should have been. However, what I think is still like there's still some like really important, you know, internal trends to discuss here, which is that, like, you know, at seed stage, you know, we are seeing rounds get a lot bigger over time on average, you know, and that's true both of like the average size round. That's true of the median sized round. And those sorts of deals really, you know, really do appear to be taking off in terms of size. And that, I think, is because, you know, they're at least on the ground, it feels like there really are more, you know, seed and angel type deals occurring, and that there are more people that are going out and starting startups. And moreover, there's now way more capital available to fund those ventures much earlier on in their business life cycle than may have existed, you know, even in the relatively recent past. And because there's now more money, and because there's now more people getting into, you know, starting either their first startups or cycling out of their last ventures and starting new ones, you know, we are seeing this uptick in both deal and dollar volume, at least according to the projections. But the underlying averages based on like the reported data, which is not influenced by, you know, any assumptions about whether or not additional deals are going to be added in the future, we do see that those rounds are getting much bigger over time. And,
you know, and I think to comment on that from the venture side, you know, I mean, I would say that I definitely agree with that. While it's much less statistically valid, just in general, the number and size of deals that we're seeing pitched to us at early stages is probably both increasing. Both the number of, you know, great deals that we're coming across, you know, is certainly up. We look at more deals probably every year than we have the year before. Our company was founded in 2012. We're now on our third technology-specific fund. And I would say we look at more deals every year than we did the year before since 2012. And we're seeing great quality in the deal flow, increased competitiveness because of exactly what you said, more dollars and funds chasing that number of deals, even though the number of deals is increasing. Overall, I would say that that's good for the venture funding landscape, even though that makes it sometimes more difficult to get into any one specific deal that you want to participate in. And, you know, on average, I would say not making a comment specifically about valuations, although it's often impacted, I would say on average, we see an increase in the size of the rounds that either we're participating in or we're being pitched to participate in. So I would definitely say, you know, even as going back to our prior point, even as kind of pragmatic valuation Midwestern investors, we definitely are seeing tangential kind of evidence that backs up these trends that that you're seeing when you look at kind of a 30,000-foot view. Yeah,
exactly. And here's the good heartening news to me, which is that like over the past couple of over the past several quarters, really over the last year of doing these reports, and other, you know, related types of, you know, the data-driven reporting that we do every day at Crunchbase News, the stuff that I have always been... So first off, Graham, like my heart is definitely with the seed and pre-seed, you know, sort of like startup community or cohort or whatever you want to call them. And it was always so disheartening to me to see that like, over time, like... seed stage deal volume and dollar volume has sort of stagnated, right? Or it has sort of declined over time, you know, in certain windows of time. And it's, you know, or it's just been stagnant or whatever. And I'm very happy to see this big uptick now because, you know, it's stuff that I commented on in the past is like, okay, like, while the market is going gangbusters at, you know, the latter end of early stage and at late stage, you know, venture investors are going to have a deal flow pipeline problem. You know, if they're like early and late stage investors, they're going to have a deal flow pipeline problem. Not exactly this second, but, you know, if companies, once they get on that, you know, fundraising treadmill, right, you know, they're on average, they're raising money anywhere between every like, 10 and 24 months. Kind of depends on the company, depends on, you know, their growth trajectory and a bunch of different factors. But like declines in seed stage deal volume in particular now might not sound terrible, but, you know, year or two down the road when you start having to fishing around for more deals and there's like fewer fish in the pond, like that will suck. And so I'm happy to see, and I'm confident that this is not just a statistical quirk of the past quarter. I'm heartened to see that period of stagnation has at least for one quarter, you know.
Yeah, and one quarter may not a trend make, but no. I mean, 24% increase in deals at that stage in one quarter.
Dollars invested, 18.5% increase in deals.
Ah, I'm sorry.
Nope, no worries.
And a 17% increase year over year, same quarter, and hitting all-time highs, I think is great news. you know, it is really exciting to see if you're on the funding side as well, I think, to, you know, to see the great things that are coming down the pipe and, you know, no shortness of innovation really worldwide to back. Because one of the other trends that I think is really interesting, and the next question that I was going to ask you about is, you know, and I know we've talked about kind of this before, with a reduction in North American and China at the late stage, but with a reduction in the number of deals, or the percentage, I'm sorry, of those deals being made up in the U.S., I think that's really good news to see the venture funding ecosystem coming online in the rest of the world, too.
For sure. And this is not to say, like, I mean, like, the market is growing in both the U.S. and in Canada. Even though, you know, U.S. and Canada, those numbers have not been fantastic for several quarters. You know, we are, let me just very quickly verify this. Hang on 1 second, Graham. This actually might be a moment where we, whatever's in the show is in the show. So you know, we are seeing growth across, you know, the U.S. and Canada and internationally, but you know, the rate of change, the rate of growth is different between U.S. and Canada and international markets, and it's growing. Deal volume, at least, is growing faster in international markets than it is in the U.S. and Canada, which is leading to a general uptrend in, a general uptrend in the proportion of deal volume that is attributable to startups outside the U.S. and Canada. That is not the case with dollar volume, which had over time, and this actually might be a time to transition to the to what might be to a discussion of what's going on in China, because dollar volume numbers are sort of collapsing. Might be too strong or too dramatic a word, but dollar volume numbers are on the decline in China in a very significant way, and the Chinese venture ecosystem is really the only one that rivaled the United States in terms of, if not necessarily the number of deals, then certainly the size of deals and the amount of money that was deployed on aggregate. You know, there was a time where Chinese startups proportionately raised more of the reported global venture dollar volume than U.S. startups did. And that was just like last year.
And what do you think that means? I mean, you know, that's obviously not a good sign about the Chinese economy, also the second largest economy in the world, you know, and I know that we've talked about this before. So with that reduction, you know, what do you think that means for worldwide startup investing and Chinese startup investing specifically? And again, I think that reduction in dollar volume is mostly constrained to the really late stages, right?
For the most part, yes, but again, like the really late, those really, really big rounds, you know, these super giant rounds, anything over $100 million, like those account for a majority of the capital that's raised in any given quarter. So like any reduction in those, even though they're relatively small in individual numbers, right? There's like, we're talking about a couple hundred deals, you know, per quarter, plus or minus. But like, because they're so gigantic, they have a disproportionate effect on the rest of the market. And so, you know, even if there's slightly fewer deals of those of that size in any particular market, this case China, that will by definition result in a big hit to total dollar volume numbers, you know, in that market.
because so much venture capital is corporate driven in China, do you think that that also means that there's other economic indicators that are not positive in China?
Oh,
I mean, that's, I guess, one of the fears that I would have is, you know, since so much VC is corporate driven in China in particular, that that it might be signaling more negative things for China's economy in the future.
Yeah.
And I assume if their economy works in any way like ours,
that's a big assumption there, for the record.
Well, sure. But I guess what I was going to say is that that they may also have some looming fear about discussions of a trade war. Without getting into larger, more political topics, I would guess that if I'm a corporation in China, I might be likely to pull back a little bit on the reins when my economic outlook is less sure than it has been in the past.
So,
without even talking about kind of a global economic downturn.
Right. So first off, you know, I'm not an economist. I don't play one on the internet. And I'm not as well versed in these numbers as many people are, but you know, I've been browsing through various economic statistics related to China, and you know, they're in the middle of a very serious run up in corporate and government debt to help support, you know, either continued growth on the part of corporations or on the part of the government in an attempt to stabilize their markets, which have been experiencing some non-trivial amount of volatility lately. So it might be a moment of saying, like, okay, well, we're now taking on all this debt, you know. It doesn't necessarily, from a corporate side, it doesn't necessarily make sense to continue investing in a relatively risky asset class, e.g., startup equity, when now we have all of this additional debt to service, and moreover, like, a debt obligation, you know, will eventually come due. There's absolutely no, there's very little certainty about when or how you can ultimately go about cashing in your stock in a startup. You know, so I do think that there's that uncertainty and increased caution around risk is definitely affecting the Chinese venture market. And whether or not there's like broader, like corporate cash flow constraints, that are also affecting that, that might also be a factor, but, I don't, to be honest, I don't have enough visibility into that market to make any, claims one way or the other.
Got it. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to think about the tail wagging the dog that much, I guess, in the dollar volume of total dollars invested by that super giant category. But of course, it makes sense.
But
I think your article calls it kind of the center of gravity of kind of the investing world. And while, again, it's such a small number, if you look at deal count, it's obviously such a huge percentage of total deals, you know, as a percentage of dollars invested. And if China's economy is slowing, or if China's investing economy is slowing, which it obviously is or has, we can reasonably project with what the numbers are today, that as the second largest venture ecosystem on the planet, you know, is a big deal.
Yeah.
And obviously something we've covered for the past couple of quarters.
For sure. And you know, I think this is a bullish. As much as this is a bearish case for folks who are in China or have invested in Chinese-based companies, I think that this is also the counter argument to this is that this is in fact a very bullish case for folks who are not in the U.S. or not in China. So e.g. everywhere else is seeming to keep growing. And so that extends to, you know, the European market is doing, you know, reasonably well, despite some, you know, economic and political volatility there. The South American market has just gone just absolutely bananas over the last, you know, really the last 9 months. And Marianne Acevedo, who's a colleague of mine at Crunchbase News, she's done a bang up job of covering the explosion in both deal and dollar volume down in South America, primarily Brazil, but elsewhere too. Africa's startup market seems to be doing really well. I keep seeing a lot of, you know, really interesting stuff happening there with like fintech in particular, just because there's such a demand, because the entire continent is sort of leapfrogging over, you know, ATMs and debit cards and credit cards and going directly to like mobile first or mobile only banking.
Yeah, modern banking standards.
You know.
Yeah, we've been watching that trend and it's been really interesting. Shout out to the folks at Ingressive Capital, not a sponsor, have gotten to know them pretty well recently, based out of Lagos, Nigeria. And so it's been really interesting to pay a lot closer attention to what's going on there. And I completely agree, the challenges that they face and the companies and types of companies that get venture funding, you know, on the African continent, I think are a lot different than the types of companies that get investment in really probably the rest of the world, but certainly the US and Canada, and I would guess China as well. The problems that they're solving are really interesting, and a lot of them end up being things that we in the US would consider basic infrastructure type things. But if the government isn't providing a service that it should be there, private companies step in and often get venture backing to solve some of those, again, more basic problems, but are doing a really great job of it. And so that's a trend that I personally, not our firm, but I personally have been watching, and that's been really, really great to see.
Yeah. And
yeah, I mean, if I had to say kind of one, you know, one or two top observations, you know, and this kind of goes right in line with, again, the article headlines as well as what you just said. But I think, you know, the biggest bullish trends are what's happening at the seed stage in deal count and what's happening outside the U.S. In China or North America and China at all stages. And obviously the biggest bearish trend is lower late stage funding, in particular in China.
Yeah. And I mean, there are other sort of other bearish things to take away from the report, less on the VC investment side and more on the exit and liquidity side.
Yeah, that was one thing I was gonna bring up as well. You know, it looks like acquisition trajectory, while IPO trajectory for companies other than WeWork, Lyft, you know, Uber, some of the really big ones, actually have been relatively positive. Looks like there's a declining trend of acquisitions.
Yeah, this has been
What do you think that causes, or what do you think's causing that?
So, this is where we get into a couple of different things, right? So one is Graham, I consistently have some amount of existential dread of around to what extent are these trends artifacts of data or to what extent these are real. So I'm going to give a possibility for why this could be an artifact of data, which is that Crunchbase News has always reported on a metric that Crunchbase has aggregated on venture-backed M&A, you know, exits, right? And so that means that in the data set, there has to be some prior evidence that a company had raised money in a venture round. So Series A, Series B, et cetera, seed, angel, pre-seed, convertible note, you know, those sorts of things. So there's the small possibility that somewhere along the line there's either many more transactions being accounted for that do not have you know, complete funding histories for their companies or whatever. So I don't know. So that like that, there's a vanishingly, or there's a chance that that might be an effect. But this has been a trend that we've documented for several like years at this point. It's just been this like long, slow decline, except for like literally this past quarter. Well, actually, decline might not be the right word. It's been a slow like decline and stagnation in venture-backed exits. And I got really excited at the end of 2018 because it looked like, you know, like there was going to be some sort of a turnaround in this number. You know, because the dollar volumes don't matter because like M&A deals vary so much in size. But, you know, I was like, oh my gosh, venture-backed M&A, you know, deal volume is going back up. It's reversing course. Really up until, you know, Q3 2019, where, you know, the capital deployed is down 38% since last quarter, and it's down, and deal volume is down 14% since last quarter. And that is not, that's not great. It's down 9% relative to last year, deal volume is. And I think like right now, what we might be seeing is, you know, companies that there might, as the economy, as like the US economy in particular, but as the global economy in general starts hitting or starts to sort of like realize that, that it's at the end of a historic cycle of like, you know, it's been a historic bull run for it, for the market in the U.S. and for most of the world as well. But that uptrend is sort of growing a little bit long in the tooth. And I'm wondering if there's a move afoot on behalf of, you know, a would-be acquiring companies, right? So typically larger corporations to hold on to more cash on their balance sheets and not deploy it quite so much into speculative or strategic acquisition offers.
You know, I think one other opportunity or one other possibility, and obviously there's more than one right answer to this question, I would think, but as companies raise more and more in larger and some later stage rounds, you know, I think even the whole trend may be that startups want to grow to a little bit larger size and get over some larger, you know, PE or, you know, other acquisition type thresholds. So, you know, I know that, you know, we've seen some companies wanting to raise another round or two and stay private longer in hopes of chasing larger M&A, you know, acquisition deals as well. So it could be that with funding, with so many dollars out there in private funding before IPOs or in this case specifically M&A stuff happens, companies may raise an extra round or two of capital and may want to go to a larger size while they remain public or remain private as well.
No. And first off, I think that you're right. I think that's definitely part of what's going on. But Graham, I gotta ask you a question. Like, From a strategic standpoint, if you're, well, I mean, you're on the investor side, but you know, this also applies to founders as well. Like, if a company goes out and raises, you know, another large-ish round, and it gets a meaningful bump in its valuation, doesn't that necessarily sort of constrict the pool of potential acquirers to, you know, a much smaller pool?
Yeah, you know, of course it does. I mean, as you know, as deals get or as later capital is raised, obviously the exit multiple at those valuations is probably smaller necessarily, but the pool of acquirers is also smaller, right? I mean, if you look at the number of acquirers who can take down the average size acquisition, which in software technology is probably somewhere in the $55 to $60 million kind of range. Obviously, if you exceed 200 million, the number of potential acquirers, and I just picked that number semi-randomly, but is sure, dramatically smaller than the number of acquirers who could take down the average size acquisition. So yeah, it's definitely smaller, but you know, with a sophisticated investment banking landscape today, I think as that pool shrinks, you also can get much closer to those companies and have one-on-one discussions with them at kind of an earlier stage, and know that you're going to have potential suitors. Hopefully, I mean, that is still a gamble if you reduce the pool of potential acquirers. But yes, absolutely. The short answer to your question is yes.
Yeah. So there's a lot of different dynamics going on to affect, you know, the exit prospects by way of M&A. And, you know, we have in the past, Graham, you and I have discussed this. And it also goes just without saying that, like, you know, when it comes to going public, you know, the sort of market sentiment matters. And that's not just sentiment around individual companies or individual business models or styles or ways of doing business. It's also just focused on how people are feeling about the broader macro economy. And,
you know, and that goes perfectly to what I think is my last question. And that's, you know, do you think happens in the future in the event that we have a bigger economic global, or at least, macro scale in the U.S. or North America, economic downturn, which we're obviously seeing signs of that is on the horizon, and probably coming closer every day, and growth, if and while it still exists, is slowing. What do you think that means for startups?
Oh, Graham, that's a that's an impossibly big question to end on.
Oh, well, you know.
What the hell kind of question is that?
I know that you're up to it. I mean, I guess I'll answer my own question. Pose the question. But, you know, I mean, yeah, obviously I think that'll change the landscape moving forward. But, you know, I mean, I think that it'll mean hopefully innovation continues. And in some ways, I think it could actually spur on additional innovation. But all of that being said, you know, I mean, I guess the short answer for me is, yeah, it's going to change the landscape. And I think investment capital is going to constrict, which obviously is probably an anti-entrepreneurial trend. But hopefully investors will be able to be more selective and choose what they really feel are some of the best deals out there for their LPs and their funds to invest in. Hopefully, I guess the continued trend of seeing so many early stage deals will mean there's a large pipeline of deals searching for next round capital that hopefully can continue to be innovative even as maybe the macro economy slows down. So I guess my argument would be, hopefully that's a good thing and entrepreneurs can find the slipstream of how they can continue to be innovative even in a larger economic cycle being down when that happens.
Yeah, so that's what I was... You answered your own question very well, Graham. I was gonna just also bring up a point that I know you and I have brought up in the past, but bears mentioning again, is that I am not a cheerleader for recessions. I do not like recessions.
Me either. Just.
I also, you know, no, I don't think anybody was suggesting that either of us were, right? You know, I don't want to, you know, worry about losing my job as much as anybody else is worried about losing their job. My modest retirement savings or whatever. That being said, if you look at the most valuable companies that have come out of this most recent cohort, you know, they were founded as a response to economic and labor conditions that were created by the last major financial downturn. So the great financial crisis of 2007, 2008, 2009. You know, say all you want about Uber and, you know, like Uber and Lyft not being able to run sustainable or profitable businesses. Sorry, they might be sustainable businesses if they certainly if Uber recalibrated its growth strategy to be more U.S. centric rather than try to keep competing for market share against better capitalized competitors internationally. But, you know, Uber and Lyft were largely responses to the fact that there's a lot of people that didn't have, you know, that were out of work and had extra time to drive around and they needed to make extra money. You know, Airbnb is a response to the fact that people had a demand for housing or I'm sorry, not for housing, but for accommodations, that there was an option to give those folks accommodations out of your own apartment while being able to help you make a little bit of extra money when money may have been tight. You know, Andreessen Horowitz, you know, whether or not the most recent IRR numbers leaked by one of their LPs to the information, you know, notwithstanding, like they're one of the bigger and definitely one of the more impactful investors to emerge in the last, you know, 15 years. And they were founded in the heart of the great financial crisis of 2007 through 2009. Like, there is a lot of recessions are not great for anybody, but you know, they do serve to shake up the ecosystem a little bit, and by shaking up an ecosystem, it can allow folks who were previously without a niche to find a niche, because those niches may get created afresh. So I think
just
that,
as a forest fire is necessary for the you know, next wave of growth to happen in a forest in a lot of cases, I think that, you know, again, hopefully when the next economic you know, cycle occurs, hopefully that will spur on the next level and type of entrepreneurs. And I'm excited to see what comes out of that cohort, because as you point out, you know, from the last one 10 years ago, we've got a lot of great companies in the gig economy, and the way kind of the flexible future of work and the world is happening, that have come out of that. So I'm excited to see what happens in the next one.
All right. Well, you heard it here first, everybody. Grand Pack 2019, burn it all down, he says.
Absolutely right? Not. Absolutely not. I am still bullish on the economy and still want to be. Reference our prior episode about global macro trends, even though that's not our typical topic.
Right.
And you will hear that I am still a bull, more even right. than my co-host.
Sorry. Okay. All right.
I'm
sorry,
not
Graham.
Saying
I didn't
burn
want
it down. Just if it does, it will be interesting to see what is catalyzed. Well, Jason, Graham, is that a good place to wrap it up?
Graham, I'm throwing you under the... Yes, I'm sorry for throwing you under the bus.
That's all right. Got to have some co-host differences in opinion for this thing to work.
Yeah, anyways, Graham, this is no longer the show. I got to run.
Same here. Talk soon.
Okay, great.